This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiotakis, and today we're at the corner on busy Venice Boulevard in West Los Angeles. It's a community garden.
Hey, how you doing? You looking for something, or?
That's Kenny Derrick. He's a manager with LA Compost, which is a nonprofit that accepts food waste. Those are the orange peels and the apple cores and carrot tops. A lot of folks drop off here and turns it into fertilizer for the flowers and vegetables grown at its gardens all across Greater LA. Now, Derrick is helping a confused resident put his food just in the right spot.
It's okay. I'll throw it in there for you. And I can throw this in there for you as well. Thank you so much for dropping off.
Out of all the trash that we throw away, nearly a quarter of it is food. And most of that ends up in a landfill where it's starved of oxygen. Then it produces methane, a greenhouse gas that's 20 times more harmful than carbon dioxide. So composting, which emits much less methane, is getting more popular as Angelenos try to figure out how to reduce their carbon footprint. Bringing all that waste to a community garden is a good option if you don't have the time or the backyard to compost on your own. All you have to do is sign up. But for now, most of LA Compost's hubs aren't accepting new people's scraps. Today on Greater LA, KCRW's Kaylee Wells pays a visit to figure out why the county's gardens are filling up and how local cities are trying to fix it.
The community gardens run by LA Compost all look roughly the same. There's a scale to weigh your food scraps, a sign-in sheet, and three massive 4x4x4-foot smelly wooden bins crawling with cockroaches.
They like to hang out in the open spaces in here, so they kind of make homes out of these.
Oh my God, you literally touched it. Residents who can brave the bugs and the smell of decaying food dump their organic waste into bin number one and cover it with some of the mulch provided.
In a healthy compost pile, we like to have equal amounts of nitrogen and carbon. The nitrogen comes from the food scraps, from the green waste, and the carbon comes from brown waste or mulch. So dead leaves or twigs or any sort of mulch from trees is considered a carbon.
Derrick says it takes about a month for residents to fill that bin. Then everything in there, about 1,200 pounds worth of eggshells and coconut husks and broccoli stems, moves into bin number two.
This pile right here right now is sitting at about 140 degrees, and the heat is really just the byproduct of the microorganisms doing their job and just eating a lot of this waste, and it ends up becoming like an oven where this stuff is just baking and cooking down.
And I can literally see it smoking, so that's normal?
That's absolutely normal, yeah. And if we were to even break into the pile a little bit, you could see the steam that seeps out of here. You also see this kind of white, ashy looking stuff. That's the mycorrhiza. That is a byproduct of the fungi in here. So, as
those microorganisms need oxygen to survive. So, every week, volunteers dump bin number two, spread it, stir it, check it, and throw it back in. That happens for another month.
Then we flip it into this third bin over here, which is where we allow it to cure. Once it reaches 80 degrees, we know that this compost is ready to be sifted and added back into the garden, into the soil.
Derrick says LA Compost does this process at each of its 32 hubs all around LA County. You sign up online, put in your zip code, and get matched with the hub near you. Except, only 8 of those hubs now are taking new people. If you live in West LA, you can't come to this hub in Venice, or any other hub on the west side. Your closest option is downtown. Derrick says it's gotten too popular to keep up.
Unfortunately, there are times where the bin reaches capacity and we unfortunately have to turn some folks away.
They're in demand because a lot of local cities don't accept compost. There's green bins, but what you're allowed to put in there depends on where you live. Some cities, like Burbank, only accept stuff from your backyard, fallen branches and leaves and grass clippings. Other cities will take whole foods like the moldy orange you never got around to eating, but not the orange peels and apple cores. That's what the city of LA does. A few cities like Santa Monica will take all your food scraps for compost, even animal products like meat and cheese that are harder to break down. It's a lot more complicated than in places like Northern and Central California. Alameda County, for example, provides curbside composting services countywide. So why are they so far ahead of LA?
Part of that is they have just easier, closer access to the and destinations for that compost.
That's Kobe Skye. He oversees the environmental program at LA Public Works.
LA County, as you can imagine, is more densely populated. And so the locations, the farms that would use the compost that's generated from our organic waste are farther out. That means it costs more to ship that material to those locations.
In other words, most of the food waste that gets composted in the city has to get shipped over to farms inland. Why not build an industrial-scale composting facility right here in town?
We also have more stringent air quality regulations. So to develop composting facilities within the South Coast Air Quality Management District, which most of Los Angeles County is within, would require those facilities to be fully enclosed and to pull and treat all of the air within that facility. And that adds to the cost for the composting significantly.
LA Compost uses the food waste to fertilize local gardens, but there's way more of it than the city's green spaces can handle. So if you do want to compost, that means figuring it out on your own. Kendra Schussel is determined to divert her food waste from the landfill. She lives in Burbank and started looking into compost last year.
We're coming into this maybe like super gung-ho and everybody's like, okay, I'm going to compost. It's going to be great. And perhaps they're not ready for that.
First, she tried a private curbside service. She paid them to pick up her full bucket of compost and drop off an empty one.
And they do that every week. And it was amazing.
But then the curbside service went away and there weren't any others servicing the area. So she turned to a local zero waste group on Facebook.
A woman had offered her backyard compost for a guy that had posted something totally different. And I reached out to her and asked if I could bring her our compost. And she agreed.
That worked for 2 months before the neighbor had to turn her away.
It seems like a lot of people are at capacity.
Her landlord nixed backyard compost for fear of rodents. She tried to start a compost system at her daughter's school, but nobody wants to sign up to run it.
There does seem to be a hesitation on more people than I would have expected part to start a compost system.
So no luck there, but she hasn't given up hope.
I'm still trying. Despite having difficulties doing it, I refuse to give up. I want my trash to become compost.
So does the state of California. A law passed back in 2016 targets the food waste going into landfills. The short-lived Climate Pollutants Law sets a goal of cutting the amount of organic waste bound for landfills in half from 2014 to 2020, and then cutting it in half again by 2025. We haven't hit the 2020 target yet, so it's time to double down. That's just what the city of LA is doing. Back in May, they started a year-long pilot program for 18,000 homes. People in the target neighborhoods can put their food scraps in their green bins. The plan is to make it a citywide service after the pilot ends. And Skye says it won't stop at the city limits.
In the next 2 years, you're going to see a major rollout by every city and county in California to meet this new law and to provide service to every resident and every business. So it's going to be very exciting to see that opportunity come out to every community.
But the financial challenges of composting in Southern California aren't going away. That means managing organic waste will become more expensive. The county's still figuring out how to pay for that. It could mean public-private partnerships and likely higher bills for trash collection. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Well, just ahead, Super Mario meets Norma Rae. How some video game workers want to wear the union label. You're listening to KCRW's Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. Thanks for being here. I'm Steve Chiotakis. All around Southern California and at other tech hubs across the country, video game and other tech workers are working to unionize. They're organizing. Emma Kinema is the person who's been leading that effort. She co-founded a group called Game Workers Unite. She organized its L.A. and Orange County chapters, and since then she has joined forces with the Communication Workers of America, which is the largest communications and media labor union in the United States, and she's leading its Campaign to Organize Digital Employees, or CODE for short, and she joins me right now. Emma, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Why'd you start this ambitious project, and why do you feel like video game workers in Southern California, specifically here in the Southland, need to organize?
Absolutely. There's a huge amount of organizing to be done because, especially in games and tech in particular, there's all kinds of issues, including low wages and sub-industry standard pay, long overtime periods of what we call crunch, where people are overworking for long periods of time, often without overtime pay, and all things like wage discrimination, lack of diversity and inclusion, poor work culture, toxicity in the workplace, so many issues to organize around. And, there's been a lot of advocacy around it, a lot of talk about it. But I think short of really comprehensive union organizing, workers don't have the real strength and power and leverage that they need to really affect real positive change in the workplace. So that's exactly what we're doing. And that's why it's really exciting to work on this CODE CWA project.
And not go to management just specifically and say, these are the issues we have. You have to have the organizing union, the collective bargaining of the movement, right?
Absolutely. It's really essential because even with well-meaning employers, and I've had really wonderful bosses actually in my career, but ultimately, the kind of needs and motivations of workers and employers are different, and we have different things to balance in our considerations. And I think it's important that workers have a sense of voice and place in the workplace, and there's some democracy where workers get to have their say and their hand on the kind of direction of our companies as well. And union organizing is how we provide exactly that kind of input.
It's not just the long hours though, and the possibility perhaps of even being laid off after all of that work is done. There's also this idea, allegations of sexual harassment in the video game industry and tech in general, as a matter of fact. Is that something that you guys are targeting?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely with some workers, wages and traditional kind of conditions aren't really relevant because some portions of the video game labor workforce is a little bit more affluent. But across all of that, both people who are struggling to get by and people who are well paid, there are issues of culture and toxicity and harassment and assault that goes on without the workers being victimized, being supported and cared for and taken care of. And so these are massive issues that need to be taken care of too.
What do you say to the person who says, you know what, you don't have to work there. You can work anywhere you want, right?
Yeah, I would like to understand what social nets and privileges they have to think they can just waltz from job to job finding the best one for them. Because frankly, for me, the vast majority of my friends and peers and coworkers in the games industry don't have that luxury. We have rent to pay and bills to pay and massive student loans and families to take care of and expensive car payments. And, often also the game industry, it's broadly based and very expensive to live places like Seattle, Los Angeles, San Francisco, you name it. And so, I don't think most people have that luxury. So I think that opinion is really disconnected from what most working class people live like and the options open to them.
It sounds like you're saying this is systemic, though, that obviously because, it's quite a large mountain to climb and you're not able to go from one job to another because all the companies or a lot of the companies are doing this.
Absolutely. And ultimately, it takes systemic solutions to fix systemic problems. And unionization and real labor organization, that is a systemic solution to systemic problems of discrimination, poor pay, poor conditions, slipping conditions, things like that. And I think we have to get really real about this. It's not just good enough to know that there are certain problems. It's not just good enough to talk about it with your coworkers. We have to be getting together and organizing to actually affect real change in our workplaces so that not just for us and our families, and our friends to have an easier life, but also for the people who come after us. I hear a lot of talk about, well, I had to work a really hard early career, and I had to sacrifice, and I had to overwork with unpaid labor, for 10 years in my career. And it's like, okay, great. Let's not leave this mess for the next generation, right? Let's leave things a little bit better than the way we found it. You know, I did my fair share personally of unpaid labor and overtime, and I worked unpaid internships to get my way into the industry. But that doesn't mean I want the next people to have to deal with it too. And ultimately, if you're okay with the industry being exploitative and requiring massive sacrifice to just get your foot in the door, what you're really saying is, I'm okay with poor folks and low-income folks and marginalized folks not being in this industry because those people don't have the same safety nets and those same level of affluence that lets them ignore those kinds of challenges like unpaid internships and low pay.
Are you getting any resistance from these companies?
In all organizing campaigns, whether, again, it's a coffee shop or a multinational tech corporation, bosses do always engage in some level of pushback, retaliation, sometimes things like various threats of firing and so forth.
Has that been happening?
It has happened, not too much publicly, but it does come up in certain campaigns as workers start to build real power and really start to affect real change. You start to see the teeth come out from some of these employers, certainly. And it's something to plan around and something that can be organized around and prepared for.
What stage are you at in this whole process? I mean, have workers at any of these shops, these big companies, actually created a union yet?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're still very much early on. Labor organizing takes a very long time. Something I tell people all the time is, you know, if you're organizing a coffee shop with 9 workers, it might take you several weeks or a couple months. If you're organizing 30 people at a grocery store, it might take you a year, sometimes a year and a half, 2 years. Now, if we're thinking about hundreds or thousands of workers at a large corporation, that takes a huge amount of time. So we are very much still in a lot of these early stages, but certainly at some of these companies, they're quite a long ways into the process. And I would argue, even before you have real, you know, legal NLRB union recognition and recognition publicly by the employer that you're a union, I think any group of coworkers coming together to build genuine worker power and change in the workplace is a union. And so we're seeing a lot of really powerful effects and creating real good change, even while some of the more public-facing acknowledgement of being unions.
Emma Kinema leads the campaign to organize digital employees, or CODE, for the Communications Workers of America. Emma, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Solidarity.
Coming up, the star of one critically acclaimed movie is a house, a style of house that you might be familiar with right here in L.A. It's Greater L.A. on KCRW. Back now with Greater L.A. on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The movie Parasite is a dark comic thriller by South Korean director Bong Joon-ho. It premiered at Cannes last year. It won the Palme d'Or, the festival's highest honor. It also racked up a bunch of Oscar nominations, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Production Design. That last one important because if you've seen the film, you know that one of the central characters in the movie is a house. A sleek, modern glass, wood, and masonry creation belonging to the wealthy Park family, where most of the movie's action takes place. And the design of it struck some familiar chords for Frances Anderton, who hosts KCRW's show DNA, and she joins us right now in the studio. Hi, Frances.
Hello, Steve.
Now, the movie takes place in Seoul, South Korea. This is obviously not Greater Seoul. This is Greater L.A. So what's the connection with L.A.?
Well, very definitely the style of the house. You could call it a kind of international minimalism, which has been the choice of architecture for people of a certain class with a certain understated good taste that you'll see in houses in Bel Air, in Beverly Hills, and many affluent neighborhoods. And what's very interesting about this style is that It is about emptiness. It is about space. It is not about stuff. This has become a style of architecture that expresses opulence, not through stuff. It's very minimalist. It's very Marie Kondo, you could say.
And it's a juxtaposition, right? Because you've got the Parks, the wealthy family, in this boxy house, right? This beautiful, minimalist, boxy house. And you've got the Kims, who live in the basement, with a lot of things.
Poverty is symbolized by clutter in this movie, which is really fascinating. It's also symbolized by lack of light. The further down the social ladder you go, the less light you have. And in fact, what happens with the house as character in the story is that the living room faces onto the garden. This is in the Parks house. They don't even have a television set. They have a large window that's very characteristic of this style, and they can sit and contemplate the beautiful view of their garden. So there's a meditative quality to these kind of houses where there's a sense of chaos in the poorhouse.
Let's talk about this wealthy house where there's not so much chaos. It is minimalist. Describe it a little bit. What does it look like?
Everything in this movie is about ascent in terms of getting to wealth. So you go up a hill to get to this house. You pass by what is a somewhat fortress-like grey wall, appears to be maybe concrete, maybe stone. This is a characteristic of this kind of architecture, very raw materials. You get to an entrance, you press a buzzer, a gate magically opens and lets you in. And there you are then approaching what is a lovely garden, and at the end of the garden is a very rectilinear house, which is a combination of large planes of glass and solid. It's what one would call volumetric. It's not, you're not looking straight on at a regular facade with a door in the middle and windows symmetrically placed. It's the opposite of that. It is a three-dimensional experience. Wherever you stand in that house, you have views of other parts of the house. That's the idea of this kind of architecture. There's a constant flow of space, flow of views, light coming from unexpected sources, and these large floor-to-ceiling windows and doors, which bring in just buckets of light. And the light is an expression of wealth in this story.
Obviously, this house is in an urban environment in Seoul, South Korea. You mentioned that this could be a house in LA. It could really be in any city, couldn't it?
Absolutely. You can find houses like this in Mexico City, Tokyo, Berlin, London. As I say, this has become the hallmark of a particular, I guess, sort of class that has a particular kind of understated good taste. Now, what I do find, there's two sort of interesting dimensions to this. One is that this style of architecture, which has its roots in Europe in the post-First World War and also in Asia, particularly Japan, as it was originally being developed over 100 years ago, it's very much seen to be associated with very progressive social ideals. It was seen to be a style that could be applied to social housing for the masses. It's interesting to me that it has become the badge of good taste for those with means. There's also another interesting irony is that this particular style of architecture has come to be used in movies as the indicator of social pathologies. In so many movies, you will see that the bad guy lives in an extreme, sleek, seemingly soulless modernist house. And what's interesting about this particular movie, the Parks are not bad people. In fact, there's lots about them that's rather endearing. But you do get the sense that as a family, they are all a bit sort of tense and anxious.
Maybe a little distant, right?
And unconnected to each other. While the Kims, on the other hand, who live in their clutter with their near poverty, they seem to get along. They seem to have a jolly time. And so that does raise the question, you know, does this cool modernist style of architecture sort of enable a certain set of relationships that might be a little bit cool to each other?
Back to the house, because this is this a set? Is it a real house? Did they film this in a real house?
Well, this is a really fascinating thing. The house is so persuasive that many people thought it was real. No, it is not real. It is an elaborate set that was designed by the production designer Lee Ha-joon for South Korean director Bong Joon-ho, who already was highly admired for his brilliant production design in prior movies, wherein they too were elaborate sets. This is a guy, I'm told, who loves graphic novels. He loves creating these elaborate stages, and it's done so well that we all thought it was a real house.
Well, the movie certainly is getting a lot of buzz. It got a lot of Oscar nominations, including for production design. So we'll see how the house fares, right, at the Academy Awards coming up.
It's a completely fascinating movie on every level. Excuse the pun.
Excuse the pun. Frances Anderton, who hosts KCRW's DNA. She's a frequent contributor here at Greater LA. Frances, thanks.
You're very welcome, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. We're online at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast, won't you? And share your thoughts with us, too. We'd love to hear from you as well. I'm Steve Chiatakis on behalf of everyone on the team. Thanks for your ears and for your time. And have yourself a great Wednesday.